give that shit up, you're going to concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Welcome to this week's edition of a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Bossy and Paul. This is the coaching podcast with a difference. We watch a movie, it might help if you watch it too, we get a special guest on, and we discuss the coaching from the movie and how it relates to our own experiences. So whether you're in the car, out for a run or a walk, or just using us to cancel out the noise from the kids in the background, we hope you enjoy.
So welcome everybody. So this week we have got Massey and Paul as always. Thanks for coming on, lads.
Hey guys.
And we are delighted to say we've got Russell Earnshaw on with us as well. And like Russell, I suppose, look, I'd be familiar with the Magic Academy, and like you do a great amount of work there. Do you want to give a quick rundown on kind of what got you to set it up, I suppose, and be a part of it, and like what you're sharing and stuff like that?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, and thanks for having me, fellas, and I'm glad you're looking healthy and well and safe. I thought you were going to say, could you give me an idea of what you do? At which point I was going to go, I haven't got a clue. So, yeah, look, and long and short of it, I played a bit of sport. I was a journeyman rugby player. I coached a bit. I got my dream job in probably 2015, working with John Fletcher, Peter Walton in the pathway with England. I was really excited about it. A year in, a big bad man came along. I knew I was going to lose my job. So I basically had a two-year run-up after this. So connecting, honing my craft, getting better around supporting coaches. And actually, one thing I recognized was that if I saw a coach, let's say, 5 or 6 times a year, then it wasn't that often. So how could we create this network where people would be connected and would have support and all the stuff I wish I'd had when I was younger coaching, like someone to make sense of stuff, to clear the fog from in my head, to say, Rusty, you're doing all right type stuff. And so every time I went somewhere, and I always like said, look, if you want to sign up, just drop me a line, because I wanted it to be on their terms, not my terms. And yeah, within, I don't know, 6 months, we had like 2,500 people sharing some stuff. Called it the Magic Academy because wanted it to be something that sounded like it was really cool. Started saying, look, you could be a wizard, because who wouldn't want to be a coaching wizard? Didn't want it to be NGBified, so actually gave them the option, the RFU, but they said no. I actually thought that was helpful. And clearly, like, we live in a different world, you know, 5 years on from then, and it's really normal now for us to be doing this or to be sharing stuff online. Or I think in terms of coaching, there's so much more possibility than there was back then. And yeah, look, it's gone from there, really. Me and Fletch both lost our jobs. We now work together, sometimes together, sometimes on our own, sport, business, whoever will have us, quite frankly. So hopefully that's a potted history of what we do.
Yeah, very good. And I think you underestimate yourself a small bit, no, when you say you played a bit of sport, like you played at a very high level.
Yeah, however, what I would say is, like, I guess I'm trying to be the coach I never had.
Yeah.
When I was professional, so just add that kind of in brackets. I had amazing coaches when I was young, had the time of my life at university. One of my most favourite away trips ever was UCD. So we played UCD a couple of times. That was a great crack. Some stories that we can't say on this podcast. And then, it was never like that again, quite frankly. And so that was tough for me, like probably in the same way, like trying to help coaches, I would have benefited from almost like a mentor, really. And I know we'll talk about the movie and belonging and connection and stuff like that. But yeah, it was quite a, like, I look back on it now and I probably wasn't as aware as I am now. It just wasn't. It wasn't the experience it could have been like. And I still speak to lots of current players and coaches, and people would look at them and go, well, they're coaching at the highest level. They're not necessarily having an amazing experiences. They don't feel like they're part of something bigger that, you know, that gets them really excited out of bed every day, which I still find fascinating. If I'm
And do you think that's because it was professional, that the, it was a different type of pressure and mindset for coaches who were coaching at a professional level compared to say, at your youth level or even college level?
Yeah, look, I think there's some tradition, isn't there, and what professional is and what it isn't. And interestingly, the teams that, you know, so Marcus Smith at Quinn's, I was asking the other day what's been the change. And first thing he said is, oh, we get Kit Kats for tapbacks. I was like, what? He said, oh, we get a Kit Kat if we win an aerial contest. You know, you guys are grown-ups, yeah? Like, and I love, I think the All Blacks talk about serious fun. So I think, like, it's interesting, isn't it? We hear words like elite, and we hear words like professional, and we probably throw them around without understanding what it means. So to me, it's not we get paid and we do what we've always done. It's a bit bigger than that, really. And I guess that we were just chatting beforehand, but one of the reasons I picked the movie is, and got really into like belonging and what it feels like to be part of like amazing teams or groups of people. I give a shout out to Owen Eastwood, whose book's coming out in May called Belonging, that I think will be amazing. And I think coaches underestimate the power of that stuff. Often it's, you know, pink and fluffy. It's, you know, whereas I think it's the foundations that everything's built on.
Yeah, and like you spoke about the movie there, the movie we're talking about is Whip It. You picked it now, so if anyone wants to make any complaints, they can send it your way. But no, it actually was. Like, I find, like, what we try to do is we look at films and we're looking at them in a slightly different context of just watching a film and trying to enjoy it, you know? We're trying to look at what coach and stuff out of it. But was there any overarching themes that you kind of picked out of it? You go, do you know what? That really resonates.
I wrote notes. So I've never written notes on a movie in my life. I thought, if they test me, I know all the names. And I picked the movie for a couple of reasons. A, because you guys have done some amazing movies. And so I said to my wife, oh, her favourite movie is Rocky. She says, Rocky 1 being done. She said, yeah. I said, yeah, Rocky 2. I was like, yeah, we're running out of movies. So I picked it a couple of reasons, really. And I'd never seen it before. But it looked like the kind of movie where actually some people who didn't necessarily fit in other areas found somewhere where they belonged. And I was really curious again, and four males on this call, middle-age-ish. and actually was interested in like the female perspective on some stuff as well. So I guess that's why I picked it. And yeah, really, like, I actually quite enjoyed it. And it looked dated, even though it was only 2000, and I think it was 2009 or something. And I was thinking, God, the world changes quickly. So yeah, that was the big themes for me were like belonging, a bit of stuff around like peer-to-peer and how important it is to kind of for those skills to be like within a group of people. I was really interested in the parent dynamic as well. So actually, at what point do parents go, wow, actually, this is really meaningful for my daughter versus what do I want? So yeah, I wrote loads of notes. I mean, loads of notes. And coaches in headbands. I mean, what's not to like about having a coach, like the cool coach wearing a headband?
One of the things that I suppose really did stand up was the belonging. Was actually, like, there's probably something for everybody, but it's a matter of trying to find it. And for Bliss in the show, was probably struggling a bit with her identity as regards what her mother wanted her to do. And she just... something triggered as soon as she seen these three girls come into the shop on rollerblades, dressed differently, look differently, and she goes, yeah, it's kind of something. And like, it's, I suppose a lot of the time mainstream sports don't really cater for the extrovert in a way, like the person who doesn't fit the norm. Like, I know in England you'd have a lot more sports than we'd have in Ireland available to kids in a normal town or a normal village. But like, it was interesting the way that she found something that really just got her interested.
Yeah, I just, as you were speaking then, like, I wrote down two things. I wrote down, like, just that look in their eyes. Like, how often as coaches are we looking for that? Where they're going, wow, this is, I'm all in here, or this is, I feel like I belong here, or wow, those people think that of me, and that is incredible. Like, so, something else I wrote down was around, it was interesting around, like, confidence and that as well. And then the other thing I wrote down when you said that was like, I actually wrote down the word beige. I think lots of environments are beige. Like, well, you know, and we want outliers. You know, think of all the amazing players that across sports just like changed the game or, you know, pioneered. And same with coaches. I actually think it's a, said this to, I had a bit of a rant the other day on a call, and apologies to those that were on it, but they actually said they felt energized at the end. But I was like, we have choices here. We can be really beige and we can do what we've always done, or we can actually be really brave and go, we're going to really celebrate people who are a little bit different. And actually, we're going to find the pioneering coaches. And yeah, hopefully that's a choice that we're taking that choice. So those were that was the kind of stuff I was thinking about. I mean, what about you guys? What does that type of stuff, you know, say to you?
I thought the peer pressure, sorry, the pressure from the mother was overbearing, and I thought like it relates a lot of children in sport. If there's a lot of pressure on to do something, they're going to rebel. They're not going to want to do it. Like she like did not want to be there in the beauty pageant whatsoever, and that's I can you know. It's for any child. If you're putting them under so much constant pressure, oh, we go here, and they're no interest, they're just going to give up. And I think that's in every sport. So I think a lot of time parents just need to step back and give the opportunity for their son or daughter to play and see that they like it and facilitate them, bring them training, bring them the matches, whatever it is. But if they don't want to be there, like, there's no point like dragging them there just for the sake of it, just because you played it or you enjoyed the sport or something like that.
Elliot Newell said to me the other day, I feel really uncomfortable with old people telling young people what they should be when they're older. And I think there's a little bit of that in sport. I thought you were going to say, Mossy, it's kind of, it reminded me of, you know, my skills in that area. But I definitely also made me think, God, how many times have I done that? Got that wrong or, yeah, not listened or not noticed.
Yeah, a really interesting thing, like, and you've talked about sports that maybe we don't get into because they're a little bit more obscure, but yet if they were going on, we'd be having a look at them and we'd stop and watch them because we take something back to our own sport. But like, I've often watched Ultimate Frisbee, right? And obviously in absolutely no way is it mainstream, but it looks like great crack and the people playing it are smiling, whereas people playing Gaelic games or rugby mightn't always be smiling when they're training. So there's that great element there as well. And they get to wear the headbands as we're mentioned about as well, and neon clothing. But you get it then as well, like you see Quidditch being played in colleges, and you have the Harry Potter Society, and they get the opportunity to play, we'll say, a sport in a non-judgmental environment where they can just have the crack and it's something different. And then you go the complete opposite end of the spectrum to something like Calcio Storico in Florence, and people are boxing the head off each other, you know? And there really is, there's a sport, or not necessarily a sport is the word, but there's an activity, a physical type of activity there for everyone. And I suppose I work in the third level environment, and I often say when talking to people thinking about going to college, if there isn't something there in college for you, make it up. Make up something, get a few like-minded people and do something you're going to enjoy and you're going to get a bit of crack out of. You know, and I see with your on your Twitter page with the Magic Academy, like you have crack in your tagline of what you're looking to do. And it does need to be front and center. Like, and you know, when you said watch Whip It, and I could kind of watch the, not even watch, but just done a quick read of a bio, I goes, Jesus, what's this going to be about? And where's he going? Where's he going here? But 10 minutes in, I was smiling, you know, and it was great crack because it was the essence of sport, or the essence of what sport's meant to be, getting back to that element of, geez, they're just having the crack and they're smiling. And like even the names they had, you know, like Razor McGee and Maggie Mayhem and 69 Bloody Holly, like they're just class.
Yeah, Iron Maven. I was writing down names thinking, wouldn't that be great in rugby if we actually I just went while you were talking there, like people way cleverer than me, like self-determination theory, like so much stuff around like in that. And I'm thinking about the other thing I'm thinking about. So at 40, I started skateboarding. I can go and do it. I can try on my own. I can learn new tricks. People celebrate innovation in it. They don't go, no, this is how you skateboard. You put this foot here and then you do this here. There's not a older person telling me what to do. Interesting. I think it's going to be interesting when those type of, you know, says skateboarding goes to the Olympics and, you know, breakdancing is in the Olympics, or suddenly might change what we think sport is. Like, because you actually corrected yourself there, Paul. You went like, not sport, like an activity. But I guess it depends what we think they are. But I'm just, you know, as a father of two kids, I can see that that's the stuff that they love, quite frankly. And as we were saying earlier, my daughter had a really poor coaching experience last week. And I do think it's often harder for the girls, like for the boys there. And I do some stuff in schools, and often the girls will say, it's not fair. We don't get to do the stuff the boys get to do. Why can't we play rugby? Why can't we play football? And it's like, it's a really good point. Like, I think it's just tradition. So I can only apologise, and I'll definitely have a chat with the headmaster about it. Just that one poor experience that she's never had in stuff. Like, so she skates with me. So she'll skateboard. Well, because she's learning herself. She's not had someone tell her she can't do stuff in front of her peers and have a bit of a go at it. And I think, I guess the other thing is, and, you know, I joke about, you know, coaching a headband and denim shorts, but how important are coaches? Like that cool coach that inspired you. I think I heard Andy Murray's mum talking about when they first got into tennis, it was because there was like this Australian coach with like blonde hair and they just thought he was really cool, and so they wanted to hang out with him. And it's like, he didn't like, wasn't like an expert tennis player, but actually just inspired them, helped them fall in love with it, nurtured them, grew them, and, you know, they did all right, to be fair to them.
Yeah.
Was it Andy or Judy who wanted to go to the training sessions for the blondie Australian?
Yeah, but it's significant, isn't it? The guy that first coached me in rugby, a guy called Jeff Hurst, not the Jeff Hurst, was a, talk about this, he was a 6'5" nightclub bouncer in Stockton at the Mall. And like when you're 13, 14, 15, like he is cool. Like, and he was awesome with us and helped us get better, you know. I think he knew some of the rugby stuff, but it wasn't about the rugby stuff, quite frankly. And I go back to the movie, I mean it just looked like they're having a ball, don't they? They're, you know, got secret moves, they got, you know, I was really interested in that kind of relationship between teams as well. So actually there's then some kind of cross-pollination of ideas between teams and sharing of stuff. And I think that's what sport's about. That's the other thing, is that it's not a 50-point victory to one team. It's actually connection between human beings. Actually, Owen Eastwood, I was re-listening to one of his podcasts last night and just said, like, we're humans. Like, we need each other. We need to belong. We can't survive on our own. And if lockdown's taught us anything, it's really hard to be on your own. We need people. We need to touch them, to be part of something, to have rituals, I don't think it's ever been needed more in our history, quite frankly. And last thing, I know we were joking about politics, but exactly the same. Like, we're quite divided at the moment. And people are deliberately dividing us.
And like what you mentioned there is our one of our recent podcasts with Liam Moggan mentioned that, we're about the 16 days of glory, about the Olympics, and about how when they're, let's say, the pole vaulters are waiting, they're all sitting together, they're all part of a connection, whereas in team sport a lot of time it's like, God, those fellas down the road, don't talk to them outside of, you know, in the match, and that's it, and don't talk to them, don't acknowledge them and stuff like that. But it is changing. Like, we, I like, in comparison to probably 20 years ago when you were still playing, like, I think the evolution of people's willingness to challenge themselves and to change and to talk about stuff, I think, has definitely evolved in sport, like, in comparison to the past, like, hasn't it?
Yeah, the and I'm definitely curious as to what you guys notice, but someone sent me a text the other day. He works at a Super Rugby team in New Zealand, and you know they're pretty decent. And he'd said, "Oh, look, this is the WhatsApp group from the opposition coaches, and they're meeting up for a beer the night before." I was lucky enough to coach England Sevens, and we'd be in the same hotel as every other team. We'd train with each other, we'd eat together, we'd form lifelong friendships with people from other countries. I think that's the purpose of sport, quite frankly. It's about the connection. It's about feeling part of something. I can pick up the phone. I can message. Just messaged the other day Carl Brown, who was the South African captain in South Africa, and potentially going to do some stuff with him. And I mean, that doesn't happen if he's like my mortal enemy. So that's not that helpful. And I don't know what it's, you guys would have some insight on what it's like over the other side of the Irish Sea.
Well, you'd see it a lot, Paul, in terms of colleges where people be coming from different counties, and you know, they might be your rival, say, when you're playing underage or whatever, and so it's just never going on with them. But then they all congregate in college, in the same college, and they make friendships for life and different ideas. And Paul, you can talk about that a little bit more if you wish there.
Yeah, Mossy, I think you sum it up there. Like, I think in GAA, be it, Russell, it's very parochial, and it's based on the place you're from, and we're the good guys, and as Colm said earlier on, we're the good guys and the fellas down the road are the bad guys, you know, or the fellas across the river are the bad guys. But we're the same guys when we get into an environment where we play alongside each other, be that at, we'll say that, county or provincial level, or you get to third level. And I really enjoyed the third level, that the element of connectedness there, where people compete against each other at the weekend and then are possibly living with each other on the Monday, you know, that kind of way. And the people who are coaching try and create this narrative of hate at times, that, geez, you have to hate your enemy, or and they're doing things and they're saying X, Y, and Z about you. But that isn't necessarily the way it is on the ground. And I think that's a bygone age of coaching, to be kind of creating them narratives around the relationship, you know. Even the scene that got physical in the film, where they were all eating and there ended up being a food fight, it was still somewhat jovial in how they went about it, you know. Like, they got good crack. Like, there was an undertone to it. It wouldn't have happened if they weren't all there, but it happened, and it helped that it happened, because it just made all relationships stronger.
I bet you never thought you were talking about a food fight at a roller derby. No. Interestingly, and clearly this is something I would do a lot, but I was on with a business the other day, and I said, I was watching this movie, it was about roller derby, and someone went, was it Whippet? I was like, yeah, it was. Like, why'd you ask? She said, oh, I used to do roller derby. And then someone else went, and there's only like 10 people on the call. So did I. And then suddenly, like, people have got a connection. She said, oh, but it wasn't like the one on Whippet, Rusty, we had the banked tracks, we had the flat tracks. And I was like, so, I mean, life is about connection, isn't it? And it just triggered me on two things. One is, in Italy, they have this real focus on the third half. So after a game of rugby, the third half is the bit that happens afterwards. It's critical. And Paul, you spoke about Frisbee, Ultimate Frisbee, and they have the spirit circle, don't they? So where both teams get in and actually celebrate the best stuff. Now, we could factor that into sport. So we have the opportunity to go, look, what stuff are we going to do to ensure there's better connection? And one of the reasons my son plays rugby, I love it, is because he just gets to meet loads of other kids in the area, and from different walks of life, from, you know, different backgrounds with different, you know, skill sets. And I love the fact that he'll, you know, he'll go meet him in the park, and he'll go, that's going to help him for the rest of his life, quite frankly. That's why he does sport.
But isn't sport such a good thing? Like, you can move to any part of the world and you just go down to whatever sport it is, and you can make your connections there. If you have an interest in that sport, it might be something that you've never tried before, and you move to wherever it is and you're playing Ultimate Frisbee, you get a group of people you know, and you make that connection. It could be any sport, and I think it's such an undervalued thing, is what sport brings to people in life.
Yeah, I'm planning a world tour after this. I haven't told anyone that I'm staying at their house, but all the people around the world. We had Mike Papata, who was our liaison officer up until 2013 at the New Zealand Sevens, and he came and stayed with us a few years back. Actually, he just, one of Amy's friends going to New Zealand, I connected him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I'll just leave the keys under the mat. He can stay at our house for 3 weeks." It's like you're a legend, but that's the reality. That's the bit where, yeah, I mean, I guess it's how do we create enough opportunities where people can find that place where they belong, where they find people that are kind of like them and that are gonna, you know, be friends for life. That's the stuff I'm always trying to think of as a parent. My daughter actually is really into, and this is, I mean, and they've done a brilliant job during lockdown, synchronized swimming. Like, how random is that? It's a little bit like a little bit like Whippet. So they take these water cartons that are empty, and they help them float in the water to help them learn. And like, they're doing this dancing stuff, and they've done loads of stuff online, and she's so excited about it. Like, she's around dancing and doing all this practice stuff. 1, 2, 3, 4. And like, she's just into it. Like, it's really creative. It's really playful. They have say in some of the stuff they do. It's kind of co-created.
And Russell, in terms of that with your daughter and the synchronized swimming, is it just the coach there is sparking a fire, and then it's up to your daughter to see what she gets out of it? Or is it kind of structured coaching, or what's it like?
I think it's two things that I've noticed. One is that, and it might not be like this everywhere with synchro. So Paula is class. She's really like, brings energy. They do online stuff that's like, they'll do like loads of different activities. They love it. It's co-created, and also it's the friendship stuff. So it's the connection between the girls, if I'm honest. And that would be the number one thing. So my daughter would very much be like, if we would say, "Oh, do you want to go to this camp? Is so-and-so and so-and-so going?" So it'd be a bit of that as well, to be fair with her. So whereas Fred, to be fair, has probably been a bit more like, I'll just rock up and go along and I'll be fine type stuff. But he's like, yeah, again, I think it's like, and it's probably his thing is sport. It's his favorite thing. Whereas it's not necessarily that for my daughter. So it's we definitely have to put more thought into it with Elsa.
I think that's really interesting around. So right, you say synchronized swimming and go online sessions, and I'm thinking, I think, Jesus, Russell has a swimming pool in his
head. I haven't got a swimming pool.
But I think we've been in this year where we've had an amount of online engagement with trying to coach in sessions. But the creativity to, we'll say, coach and engage and synchronize swimming when you haven't got a swimming pool just shows what coaches can be when they think a little bit outside the box. And I don't think we always do that. And like, you come back to the coach in the film, and he has his playbook, and sure, the girls have no interest in any of the plays because it is just that social thing for them. And I thought it was great to get his point across that these plays are good, that he gives it to the opposition, make a fool of the girls, and then they go, "Well, you know what, you actually might have it." There might be a bit of context and underpinning logic to what you're going to say, so we might actually listen to you now. So I thought it was, there was really good elements there in that, and I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's coaching, isn't it? You actually, if you were if you were really serious about development, then you actually would tell the opposition your game plan, and you would give them your playbook, and you would give them clues to challenge your players. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but if you wanted people to be really good, then you would do that regularly. Yeah, look, I've experienced that. So I've been to Israel. I did a bit of coaching in Israel. I took their sevens team to Germany and just spent my time with the German coaches. Like, look, here's some ways you could beat us. Have you thought about this? Have you noticed that we defend like this? So this might work for you type stuff. And just let, you know, the players can then kind of work some stuff out themselves. And yeah, I mean, that would make sense to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because Paul would have actually said that to me probably 5 years ago about, like, you're not the smartest man in the world. Share your stuff. And what Paul actually said is that by you sharing what you're doing, or if people know what you're going to do, you have to become a better coach to evolve and be better. And like, Jesus, no, I was sharing a whole load of stuff for a long time there online, just on Twitter, with coaching resources for GA. But it all came from a change of mindset from Paul just challenging me like that. And it's something that doesn't happen in amateur sport. I think professional sport are much more open to that kind of thing, you know, of sharing resources. Like you're saying, that you're sitting down with an opposition coach and you're talking about what we do to PT and what you do to beat us, you know, because that challenge for a coach is really how they will improve, like, isn't it?
Nice. Paul, how did you feel when you told Colm that?
I don't know, it would have been a few points in at that stage, Russell, I'd say.
I love it. That must be an essential for coach development, 3 points.
Yeah, I think it is. Something came up there that I remember one time we were playing a challenge friendly match with another team, and the manager of the opposition team asked me, would we set up in a certain way? And I thought it was an extremely strange request, because I suppose they were preparing for something. And I says, yeah, no bother. And we went to the match, and of course we didn't set up the way he wanted us to set up. And he goes, I thought you were going setting up like this. I says, yeah, I know you thought we did, but we're after setting up like this. Deal with it. And him going in with, we'll say, a preconceived idea that I'm going to deal with this team because they're set up like this. He didn't get the opportunity to do that, but it was actually better learning for him because he had to adapt on the spot. And that's, it really stood out to me, because we have an idea that going into a game that a team are going to do X and Y, but if they do P and Q, and we haven't thought about it, we're in serious bother, like.
Yeah, I mean, we often assume they haven't trained in the week, or they haven't, like, put some stuff together. Some stuff that I just wrote then, I mean, it really resonated. I hear more youth coaches talking about the big game than, like, actual coaches at the top end. The big game. Like, what, the under-13 game against, like, the team that are quite close to you is the big game. Who's it the big game for? My view would be, the more you share, the better you have to be, the more people you help. Like, I would have loved people to have shared more with me. It's ultimately about, like, the how. So you can share lots of the what, but you've got to be able to deliver the how. And then, yeah, the two more things. One was, like, at some point, Coleman, sounds like you've all experienced it, you've got to realise the players are going to be miles better than you ever were. Like, with due respect, like, if players were as good as me, then that's not that good. And that's, like, I think that's kind of hard to start with, but then it's really liberating, because you can go, okay, like, I don't know everything, so this is pretty cool. Let's explore some stuff. What could you do? And then the last thing is, I mean, and Paul, this for me is where I think it's a big kind of starting to shift a bit in coaching. Every session I took part in as a player, everyone knew everything. That is never the reality of the game. So who we give information to is a critical coaching skill. So for me, I would rarely play a game where both teams have same scoring system. So that game you're talking about, Paul, both teams have got a slightly different scoring system because they've got different players. And they've clearly got the same scoring system, but they've got a different way of getting to it. So they might be going, actually, we're trying to score out wide because Paul's team aren't that quick and they defend narrow. So maybe it's for them, it's double points for scoring out wide. So, and same again, like don't tell everyone all the rules. Tell two people and then challenge them to, while the game's going on, tell everyone else. Because, again, that is the game. Someone works something out. So Mossy works something out and he goes, well, I've got to tell everyone now. All right, how am I going to do that while we're still playing the game? Okay, all right. So that's a skill. Yeah, I think that's the bit where, you know, and the huddle, this kind of mythical creature that exists in our sport that doesn't exist that often in a match and in other sports, some of your sports especially, there's way more ball in play. The huddle doesn't exist, really. In hockey, the huddle doesn't exist. In football, it doesn't exist. However, there's a lot of huddles in training, and Doug Lemov, I like the way he speaks about it, like there's a diminishing marginal return on a huddle. So the longer you're speaking, well, the more stuff you're telling them, so probably the more they're forgetting about what's important. But also, if we're speaking about something here and we've done a six-minute huddle, well, we're 6 minutes further away from practicing the thing we were talking about. Well, actually, we could have practiced it a bit earlier. So I would probably, like, freeze, like, stand where you are, and then at least we all see the same picture. So there'd be some coaching stuff that hopefully that coach that played against you learned, Paul. Maybe they didn't.
You know what? It's interesting you say there, if we all stand and we freeze frame, we all see the same thing. We actually all see different things.
Sorry, correct.
We all see different things, but we see it from our perspective rather than in that huddle. And it's just the coach's perspective of this is what you need to do at a particular time. But if we're not standing out in them positions, it can at times can be really difficult to conceptualize it.
Yeah, sorry. So good pickup on me. We will be in the position we're talking about. So we're not all in a huddle imagining slightly different stuff, but of course we will see different things. So as a coach, understanding what your players are seeing is critical. Like, what have you noticed? Close your eyes. Like, where's the fullback? Paul, what do you think Mossy's seen? Is a really helpful question, because actually you want to start seeing what Mossy sees. So Mossy might be, and I can't tell from Zoom, he might be 6'6" and 120 kilos of solid muscle. And you
close
might,
enough. You're close enough there, Russell.
Paul, you might be 67 kilos, 5'2", and because of some of the experiences you've had, then you might see some stuff that he doesn't see. He might not see kicking as an option. He might see a small guy in the defensive line, a person small him as an opportunity to go forward. You might actually check backfield, and you might be looking to avoid being tackled. So clearly we want this kind of shared mental model of on the pitch of what we're seeing, but it's also got to recognise, I guess, the individual strengths. And as you said, I think it's easier to have those conversations and develop that stuff frozen rather than in a huddle where we're all imagining slightly different things.
And it's frozen within the game context. I wouldn't be mad into rugby, but I've watched a lot of it over the last 2 months and have really enjoyed the analysis of games on the telly, because I think they go really in depth, whereas our sports are, they don't as much, you know, they don't go into that technical and tactical detail as much, because I don't think the commentators are as clued in at times as the rugby commentators. But like listening to Ronan O'Gara, and he's able to put himself in the position of Johnny Sexton and talk about the different options that are there, or Owen Farrell or whatever it is. And it's great to get that insight of what's actually happening. And you can see, just by discussing things out, that we'll say player knowledge or former player knowledge can be massively powerful as well.
Yeah, and Ronan O'Gara is a good one to pick, isn't he? Because actually, I mean, he would A, be able to do that, and B, the stuff we're talking about, he went over to the Crusaders and got punched in the nose. Like, literally thought, you know, if this piece of paper was coaching, he thought he kind of knew a lot of it and stuff, but actually realised there was a big piece of work around belonging, identity, theming, all the stuff. they would do at the Crusaders, and some of the kind of interviews he's done, I think, have been remarkable in terms of him being really honest with, actually, I just wasn't aware of this stuff. And so clearly he's having great impact at La Rochelle in France, and starting to bring some of that stuff into his commentary. So he has the tech tack, but he's also starting to understand, like, how do environments work? How do you connect people up? How do you... Crusaders have got this remarkable... It's something like 2 or 3 years they haven't defended... they haven't conceded off a driving maul. And it's like... Driving maul is like a pretty common way of scoring in rugby these days. And there's a clip on it on Twitter at the moment, and people talk about the tech tack. And of course, there's some technical stuff there around their body height and how they're connected and which areas of the maul they're targeting. But actually, they have this ceremony and this ritual that where they hammer a nail into this piece of wood, is what I've heard, and they're connected around that. So it's almost this bigger thing than actually the tech tack. So yeah, I think it's a great... Ronan O'Gara is definitely, like, he's killing it on the commentary.
I'm really excited about him coming back to be at Munster or Ireland because of the coaching journey he's taken, where of course he could have went straight into Munster and just been in that exactly what you're actually saying, that exact same environment he's always been in, but he goes to that different environment and is completely out of his comfort zone and is nearly back to a complete novice in terms of where he is, and he builds it up. He's nearly built up two coaching identities, of the one he learned as a player within the Munster system or the Irish system, and then the one where he's after learning the different cultures of different clubs, you know. And I think when he does, we'll say, get a big gig in Ireland, I'd be really interested to see some of the dynamics of how he goes about it, who he brings in with him, what subtle changes to be it Munster or Ireland that he makes, you know. Be interesting.
Yeah, and I would call it like karaoke moment, and I'm sure Ronan O'Gara is a miles better singer than me. But in order to grow, you've got to have those moments where you're thinking, I'm about to sing, you know, The Bright Side of the Road, and I'm not sure this is going to go well. But he's just creating moments for himself, isn't he? He's packed his bags, gone off to the Crusaders. He's now gone into France, where he's got a coach in a foreign language. Like, wow, that is a great coaching challenge, like, around... How can you make your language? How do you know that it's being received? How do you know that's under the ballpark? And that would generally be my recommendation to coaches, different contexts, different languages. Imagine if he then went, actually, for a year, I'm going to go and coach GAA. And then I'm going to go back to rugby. I'm going to actually take this to the next level. So, yeah, that would be, you need those kind of disruptions. And whether it's, you know, 3 pints in the pub comb with Paul, and him doing that to you, that's the stuff that excites me really around coaches. And yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see where he ends up with all of that.
So the big question is, would he be as good as Razor with a group of women, the horse goats? Would he be able to be the chameleon that goes into that environment?
I think it's coaching teams. So if you've got Ronan O'Gara's got to understand what his empty chair is. So if there was Amazon talk about, like, they have this empty chair in meetings and it represents the customer. And we always go, well, what would the customer be saying now? So maybe like Razor and Ronan O'Gara are each other's empty chair. Like, maybe they would be a brilliant coaching partnership, quite frankly, because it seems like Razor's a really good dancer. I'm not sure if Ronan O'Gara is. I know, because I speak to someone who does a bit of work with Ronan O'Gara, that my mate is fulfilling some of the empty chair. So he's remotely doing some stuff that's helping Ronan O'Gara do some of the stuff that Razor does. So I think it's coaching teams. And once again, like, God, we could open a can of worms around recruitment, couldn't we? We could actually go, how well do people agree, like, look, what is it we're missing? What's going to really drive this team forward? What's going to disrupt us? What's going to make us think differently? And let's go and find that person. Because as Dave Slemon said to me on the pod the other day, like, if you're recruiting especially for at the level we're talking about, then you can pretty much get most people. Like, you can buy people out of contracts, or you can find them. And often we don't look that widely. We're often looking in quite a narrow place. So, yeah, look, I think it'd be fascinating. And I actually, I'm sure it's something that O'Gara's thinking about, is how do I put together a team of people that are going to help players like smash it.
As Mossy put out the call now, that Ron O'Gara wants to come on here and give us his answer.
Yeah, the
open invitation. Yeah. So was there anything else in the film then? Like I said, I think the parental influence was huge, and that you had, it eventually came to a case at the end where the parents just wanted their child to be happy.
Yeah, I was on a call last night, and we were talking a bit about this, and someone said, the parents are really important when they're younger, because, you know, they drive them, and which is true. I actually also think they're really important when they're older. So, Hugo Monu will often talk about this and say, like, why wouldn't Eddie Jones know the parents of some of the players? Because the reality is, if it's like, let's say it's Marcus Smith, then he speaks to his dad loads about rugby, and his dad's really influential still and important to him. And why wouldn't he have a relationship or know that? I know that person's parents. I think it's just really interesting. And I guess, I don't know about you guys, it definitely made me reflect upon, like, times when I've got it wrong as a parent, which is pretty regularly, and probably insisted on some stuff that probably was for me and not them. I don't know. What are other people thinking about with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You often... do things for you rather than for your children or for your team. I think you mentioned it there earlier on about the synchronized swimming. And what I like there is that you said that, what age is your daughter?
She's 10.
She's 10. That she had a say in the training. They had their input, and the input was, the coach took that input and is using it. And I think it's very important for children when they're playing that you listen to them. If they say something, oh, we're not enjoying this, or this isn't going well, that you find out why, and then you can adapt. So I think it's very important as a parent and as a coach that you listen to your students or your children.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of work with a few academies on that. Like, I did some stuff with Worcestershire Cricket, where the kids were designing a session with their parents kind of watching and seeing what was important to the kids, and actually the parents then designing one and going, well, we would have done it, and then just exploring the gap between the two. The other thing I wrote down as you spoke there, Mossy, was like, I hear loads of people say I'm player-centred, and I'm thinking, cool, so how much of the planning are the players involved in? How much feedback do they give to the coaches? How much co-creation goes on? Actually, I did a Zoom call with a rugby club, and I just said, look, just put in the chat box. Be honest, how long do you think it would take for your kids to run the team themselves? So put the age group in and put how many weeks or months or years. A month was the longest. I actually don't think you have time not to do that, because actually if you rock up and the kids are running some stuff, then you can coach and you're probably a bit more chilled and you maybe speak to the parents and you can, of course, nudge them on and, you know, is this, you know, what would level 3 of this game look like? Of course. I think we're miles away. I think, like, co-creation is, like, essential. It's not, like, optional. I've had coaches say, what are the favourite games that the kids play? Actually, I haven't got a clue, Rusty. So what games are you playing? Just the ones I find on, like, YouTube. So I did another Zoom the other night, and I basically showed a game to some kids. They were aged between 12 and 16. I said, look, here's a little rugby game I'd play. You've got 2 minutes to come up with 10 ways of making the game better. Literally, I'm like writing stuff down. I'm like, yeah. Thanks, lad. I'll be claiming that one.
Yeah, rubbing the ideas.
And I was like, coaches, put your hand up if on a Saturday night you are sat at home stressing about what practice you're going to do on a Sunday. Everyone puts their hand up. I'm like, the kids, like, genuinely, they'd love to help. Kids, would you love to help? Yeah. So actually what I've tried to insist on more is, if I'm doing, like, and it would happen more in real life anyway, because we would do player and coach development alongside each other. But if I do a Zoom with a club, I'll go, look, make sure you invite some kids on, because I'm generally just going to quiz the kids. Like, tell me about the stuff the coaches do that's great. What's your favourite stuff? One of the lads on one the other day was like 17, 18, one of the better players. And I said, oh, what's the best stuff? He said, oh, when the coaches give us points for creativity. And they're all, you know, this is one of the better players. Sometimes you think these kids are like all about winning and performance. And he's like, I still want to learn new stuff. Like, I'm 18. I can still keep adding to my stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't know, was it you, Massey, said to me a couple of years ago that you used to do in school, that with No Man's Land, that whichever team won could put in an adaptation to it the following week. Yeah. I know that you said that in service, but I did it inside in the girls' school. No, I find girls are way more creative than boys. That's, boys are kind of more competition orientated, get the win. But girls are kind of open up. And we were playing No Man's Land, and I don't know if you're familiar with Russell, but a team on one side and a team on the other side, and there's a No Man's Land in the middle. And we play it in hurling and football, where you just either hit the balls into the other side or kick them in. So you can do it with junior infants, with the smallest 4-year-olds, or you can do it with a senior inter-county team. But there's, as you said, steps in between to get up there. But I said to the girls, I said, right, whoever wins can come up with a new adaptation. And they said, right, we want to make 4 squares instead of 2. So all of a sudden I was going, geez, that's actually good. Now they're kicking that way and that way and that way. And this ball's coming from different angles. And the following week, what they said is that if you catch somebody else's ball, a bit like dodgeball, they go into a jail at the back. So the person that kicked the ball, if another person catches your ball, the person that kicks it goes into a jail and they can't be set free till somebody else kicks a ball into them. So I'm going, Jesus Christ, I wouldn't even think of it. And Massey, I know you're kind of the same. Is it similar with Donald's End or something?
Absolutely. They come up, they're so creative. Like, like my daughter is 5, and every day I ask her, what did you play in school today? And they come up with these weird names of games. And I say, what does that involve? Or what does that do? And they're just so creative. Like, I dropped her off to school yesterday morning, and one of her friends came up, they're waiting in the line, and they have a minute or two to run around, and they had a game of tag, just 2 of them. So I was just watching, observing. And like, these are 5, so they came up the game. So you run, you touch someone, but they count to 2 before that person's on. So you get that chance to run away. Like I said, I've never showed her this game or improvised this rule or anything. Like, so they just come up and be creative themselves. And it's just like, I think at the start of any training session, you can just, especially for the younger guys, just play away there. And they'll come up with something. They're not just going to sit around on their asses. Like, they're going to do something. And it's creative, it's enjoyable, they're having fun, they think they've came up with the game, so they're, you know, it's all good.
And I would always have options just in case they can't think of anything, but they always do. I mean, in fact, Colm, as soon as you said No Man's Land, I was intrigued. I was like, oh my god, like, you're taking kids to World War I, what's going on? It's exciting. And then I thought, oh, is it just dodgeball? And then it wasn't dodgeball, and then there's this jail, and we'll have. Yeah, I'm really, I mean, as I'm sure people know, I'm into like some of the Amy Price stuff around video game design and just really like trying to understand like the learning principles from there, but also some of the language. Like, how can we be more playful with our language? Is it, you know, so what does the next level of this game look like? Yeah, I love the idea of having this prison and you can release someone and they're more creative than us.
Oh, big time.
I was actually at a talk by Amy Price there a few weeks ago, and like, it was genuinely, you'd be mad to just be a 7 or 8 year old child involved in one of the training sessions, just because of the way things could be linked into whatever they wanted them to be. And it's just pure imagination.
I think it'll be really normal in 5 to 10 years. So I'm working with a few places that are performance environments that are like all in on it. So New Zealand Sevens, Kenny Lynn's doing it at Lyon in France. There's loads of, I'm like, it's the, for me, it's the best way to create games players. People who understand the game can problem solve, can pose problems to the opposition, can understand when and why to use certain types of tactics. And the other thing it brings out is the kind of psychosocial stuff. So there's, you know, when someone's locked in a game or being knocked down a level or they're like, oh, type stuff, then now we can explore some stuff around like, what's going on in your brain at the moment. This is exciting stuff. I think it'll, I mean, it'll be interesting. And the same with, like, we're trying to play around with it in coach development. So actually, how can we video game design coach development as well?
Interesting. It'll be, as I said, kids in 10 years' time will have a lot better than we did back 20, 30 years ago. Well, in a way, in the confined sports, because I always use the example in workshops that we, my generation, were probably the first group that would have did a proper training, as in regular trainings, whereas my father's generation would have just played. They would have just went out and played the sport. There was no huge tactics. And it was going back to the grassroots of it, of going out and playing for the enjoyment. And our group would have been, our age group would have been the first group that really got organized training sessions. But the coaches, a lot of the time, were getting no skills to be better. And they were doing stuff that they probably did with the adult team 10, 15 years ago. And it wasn't as child-friendly. No, it was grand. We loved it. But as I said, the way it's just adapted with the content that you're providing yourselves and the avenue for people to learn now, like, there's no excuse for coaches not to be improving every single year.
Yeah, I'm really jealous of some young coaches. Like, I'm thinking, you are now where I was like 6 months ago. Like, you have access to everything. You can go and watch other coaches. You can go and co-coach. That would be another thing I would recommend. Like, just go and coach with people different once a month, maybe in different sports, or go and ask if you can, like, act like a coach developer for someone for a period of time so you can learn more about coaching. But I'm really jealous of what they have. And as you said, like, the kids as well, like, so much more opportunity than us. The kids coming through are certainly the youngsters in rugby they're mega skillful. Like, you know, they can slot straight into premiership teams. It's Fletcher I work with, I'm going to say it. He said, I actually think the youngsters are overqualified for the premiership. Because they are, you come out 18, 19 and their skill level now, clearly there's some physical stuff as well and remaining injury-free and robustness and that stuff. But from a skill point of view and scanning and decision-making, I think they're way ahead.
Yeah, interesting.
It's exciting for what's to come in the future in sport. Entertaining.
Yeah. Great.
That's brilliant. Any final things on the film, Russell, you want to mention, or have we got it all covered?
I think we've roughly covered the film. Well done, everyone. Top work for watching it. Some quite famous actresses and stuff in it, wasn't there? I was like,
yeah.
Is that so-and-so? Oh,
yeah, herself was watching it with me, and she goes, there's a brilliant cast in this. And I was going, is there? Yeah, and she started naming them out then, and I was going, oh, yeah. But yeah, no, it's excellent. So
the guy from Home Alone was the dad in it.
Was he? My wife didn't say that, because she'll always... I know she didn't watch it with me. She would have spotted it.
Right. Russell, thanks very much for your time. Would you give us a quick, where can people find you, and just give a quick link to Twitter with the Magic Academy and yourself and stuff like that? Because look, I know a lot of our listeners will be keen to, I suppose, follow on, as if they're not already doing so.
I think I'm at Russell Earnshaw on Twitter. I've taken it off my phone, which is a it's now just on my laptop, which is chilling me out a bit more. And then I think we're the magicacademy.co.uk. That's probably where we would, like, we have to have cards and things that people might be interested in. And then we've actually got a sharing site on Coach Logic that you can kind of access via the other website. So, and I'm always like, if you send me a message on Twitter or anything, I'll always reach back out to people and help if I can. So, yeah, those are probably the best places.
Brilliant, Russell.
That's brilliant, Russell. Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, lads. We're into season 4 now, so thanks to everyone who has listened so far. We would be grateful if you would take the time to give us a retweet on Twitter or just share with your friends. It would be great if you could give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a lot to us, and we really appreciate that. Hope you all have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday when we're talking to Gerard Brennan about the movie White Men Can't Jump. Bye, everybody.